Blog Talk.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robin. It's a great Saturday afternoon, and I'm so happy that you guys are all here joining us. We have a fabulous show for you today. We are going to have author Tasha Alexander, who's going to be calling us live from Love is Murder Convention, which is going on right now in cold Chicago, Illinois. And then we're going to have Starina come on the phone and talk about her book, which is Deadly Decisions, which just came out. So I want everyone to kind of sit back, relax, enjoy yourself, because 60 minutes of Suspense Radio, and I am going to be a little bit more suspenseful, because we are going to also announce the top 10 finalists of the Suspense Magazine Short Story Contest, and that's going to come a little later in the show. So right now, sit back, relax, and enjoy, because 60 minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now. Nice Saturday afternoon, 71 fabulous degrees in Southern California, and I am rubbing that in for all the people that had to endure some great weather in the Midwest and the South. I know the Super Bowl was being hit with some ice in the Northeast. You know, sorry about your luck. Sorry it happened that way, but hey, you know what? That's why 25 million people live in Southern California along with myself, because of the great weather, and it's 71 and we can, you know, enjoy ourselves outside. So, like I mentioned, at the little bit later in the show, we're going to announce, Oscar style, because it is Hollywood, the top 10 finalists of the short story writing contest for 2010 Suspense Magazine. The winners will then be announced in the issue coming up. So these are the top 10 finalists, and you'll be able to vote maybe on which one you like the best and then who you like. And, you know, we're just going to do it that way. But before that, our February issue is available. You can go to suspensemagazine.com, check it out. One of the authors that we're going to have on today, Tasha Alexander, is in the magazine. One of the best right now romantic thriller writers in the genre, so you want to make sure you check out her interview along with Allison Brennan and some others that we have in there. Some other astonishing news we talked about last time was Borders, doing a little bit of 180 here and deciding that they are probably going to file for bankruptcy, and it could be as early as this week coming up. Not really alarming news, not really shocking, but you know what is very disturbing is the fact that they are holding back their remittance to their publishers again for their second straight month. They said in December that they would not do that. Now they come back in January and February, and they've done it again. So publishers are having to wait for their books, which is hurting the authors because, you know, they're not receiving their royalties. And, you know, we don't really find that you know, very valid. I mean, it's not really working, which is, you know, I think which is why we kind of tore out of Barnes & Noble because their remittance is now back to 9 months, and things are hurting out there in the book world. But ebooks are very popular, and I think that that's a way to go because those are extremely great. But without any further ado, let's get in here to our first guest who's calling in from the Love is Murder Convention in Chicago, Illinois, the great romantic thriller writer, talking here, Tasha Alexander, and about her latest book, which is Dangerous to Know. Tasha, thank you so much for joining us, and how are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me. I'm looking out over a very snowy city. I won't send yes. any of it your way, however.
I'll tell you what. Well, if you did, it would melt before it came here, which is good, and then we just get nice water.
So that's that is true.
But nice 20 inches of snow in Chicago. But I'm glad the convention still went on and it didn't stop anything because it is a great convention. We were talking a little bit off the air. We have not had a chance to be there, but you're having a great time. Your panels are done, but fans are kind of getting, you know, up close and get to know you, and you know you can kind of interact with them and talk about your latest book, Dangerous to Know, which was available in October. So can you tell a little, you know, everybody a little bit about Dangerous to Know and, you know, kind of the conception of it?
Yeah, well, the series that I write is set in the 1890s, and it's the story of a young English Victorian woman who, in the first book, she's widowed. I wanted to explore a young woman going from a very sheltered, repressed environment to becoming an enlightened, forward-thinking person who's ready for the turn of the 20th century. And, of course, solving lots of mysteries and dealing with all kinds of suspenseful things in between. It's a great time period because so much is happening in Europe. It's a time when women are finally in a situation in England where they can come into their own. They're finally allowed to own property separately from their husbands, for example. So in Dangerous to Know, my heroine, who is now I guess she's still – once you're widowed, are you always widowed even if you get remarried? How does that work?
That's a good question. I think you might still be considered a widowed, and then you're just remarried.
Yeah. Well, she is now remarried, and she's come off of a very bad situation that occurred during the previous book, Tears of Pearl, where she had...
Aren't women all coming off bad situations if you're remarried?
Generally speaking, yes, I would say that. But she has had a particularly bad one where she's been, yeah. She was on her honeymoon and got shot in the midst of trying to save someone who was going to be murdered, and lost a baby because she was pregnant. She didn't know that. But because that's a big issue for Victorian women. You know, we take for granted that childbirth is basically safe. And for the Victorians, that was a scary time. And women died in childbirth. Infants died. The mortality rate was really high. So I felt like you can't write a series set in that time period and not address those issues. So Emily has come off of this terrible loss and is physically recovering from the wounds she suffered. And her husband, who, despite being rather intelligent and very enlightened, makes the not-so-great decision to bring her to his mother's house for her to recover. And I imagine that there are many people who might not choose their mother-in-law as the person to oversee their recovery from trauma.
True.
But, you know, the house is this gorgeous old place in Normandy in the French countryside, and he thinks it'll be relaxing. And of course, he's wrong, because soon after they get there, Emily is out riding and stumbles upon, as you do, you know, if you're a heroine in these kinds of books, you're constantly stumbling on things that most of us would rather avoid. But she comes across the body of a young woman who's been brutally murdered in the style of Jack the Ripper.
Mm-hmm.
And Emily, of course, being the detective sort, isn't going to turn this all over to the police instantly. I mean, the police are involved, but she's not going to stop thinking about it until she knows who the murderer is.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, you bring in the Jack the Ripper kind of inflicted wounds, but away from London and into the south of France, almost like he could have possibly moved from that area and moved down to someplace else.
Yeah.
And that kind of gives somebody, and I don't know if people would have thought about that, but that kind of gives you a little bit of, you know, pause, like, you know, what, you know, like, what's going on here with that? Because that's very interesting.
Yeah, well, I did a lot of research. Well, because at the time, you know, when you start writing a book, I obviously knew who the murderer was going to be, and I knew why he was doing what he was doing. But you have to put yourself in the shoes of that villain and think, okay, well, if you've decided to commit this heinous crime, what's the best way to remove suspicion from yourself? And so I was researching Jack the Ripper, and I found that there were all kinds of rumors that he was in France now and that he'd killed people in France. And it made me start thinking, well, hang on, what if he wasn't in France, but you just sort of took the opportunity to kill someone in the manner of Jack the Ripper, thinking he'd get blamed for it.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking almost like kind of a first kind of copycat serial killer to try to, you know, lay blame someplace else. Now, the one thing that I wanted to know, too, is there's all the new technology and techno thrillers and all the CSI and everything that's out there today. Which do you feel is more challenging for an author, is to go back like you've done and to basically have, you know, police work, which is keen instincts, not a lot of forensic analysis that can be done, or having to stay up on top of all the CSI and the techno thrillers and the things like that? Where do you think the most challenge for an author?
Honestly, I think they are both incredibly challenging, because there are certainly times, particularly when I'm at that almost the end of the book, just figuring out the denouement, and I think, why did I decide to write historicals? It would be so much easier if you could pull out a gun or blow something up. And, of course, theoretically she could have a gun, but it doesn't quite go with her character. I think, you know, you think, if there was just a cell phone, you know. But then I see the flip side of that. My husband is a thriller writer, and he writes contemporary espionage books. And it's a huge problem for people working in that area, because there are cell phones. And, well, why don't you just call someone? And, you know, the technology can be a curse or a blessing. Sometimes both simultaneously.
And that's
but it
the
really,
beauty.
It put, oh,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, it pushes you into corners. And I think whenever you get pushed into a corner, it really keeps you from becoming lazy in your writing. You know, I mean, I can think of times where I was pace and beat my head against the wall for days thinking, how can Emily get herself out of this situation? I'm so limited by the technology and by what she can. I mean, she's a woman. She can't go beat the crap out of somebody when she's wearing her corset, you know. It's just not plausible, and I think it's really important to stay plausible. But what the limitations do is force you to think harder and to come up with something more creative, you know, instead of just taking the easy way out, which is good in the end.
Right. That's what I'm going to point out. That's what makes your book so much more, I guess, beautifully written, is the fact of that you do have to, you just can't cop out and whip out a 38 Magnum and shoot somebody's head off, or push a button and blow up a building. You have to be more creative, and you have to, you know, use your brain to the fact of saying, you know, how am I going to intertwine this and make this all work out correctly? Because you're not writing in that time period like a Sir Arthur Conan Doyle or Agatha Christie was, which that's all they had. You have to put yourself back there, and without living there, it makes it so much more difficult.
It does. But it's interesting, though, because one of the things that drew me to that time period is that if you look at the late 19th century, you had these women who, despite living in incredibly repressive environments, they did the most extraordinary things. They pushed those bounds. And, you know, Gertrude Bell went and mapped Persia. You had women doing amazing things, the early suffragettes. And, it, you know, so the idea that now in the 21st century we have to think harder about what it's like to really deal with those restrictions. You know, obviously societal ones are different than technological, but, you know, it's always good to be to push yourself.
And of course, the biggest question, you probably get this asked a lot, is why then, and you might have already answered this with all those answers, is why the Victorian age? Why write about the Victorian age?
Well, there are several reasons. I mean, first, the practical one being that I did want to be able to write about a young woman coming into her own. And that, for that to be credible and plausible, it had to be late enough in the 19th century that she could, for example, own things separately from her husband, because you can't really be free and independent if you're absolutely subjugated by another person. So it needed to be after the Women's Property Act, which was passed in England in, I think, 1887. Don't quote me.
I'll believe you on that one.
It had to be after that, because before that, women couldn't own things. So one, I was constrained by that. But two, the 1890s, there's a lot politically going on in Europe. You've got anarchists in Austria and Germany, and you've got lots of political change. You've got things settling down in France, after the Revolution and Napoleon, and, that things are finally getting stable again there. But everything going on in Europe in the 1890s is leading to World War One. So the place really is a powder box ready to explode, but nobody knows it. And I just find that so fascinating, this idea that you've got this culture that thinks it's peaking. It thinks, these people were living in the Gilded Age. They had wealth that we can hardly, well, maybe now people can imagine it somewhat given the way things are going right now.
Yeah.
For the people who are extremely fortunate. But, for the most part, these people thought they were sitting pretty. And little did they know, this was the twilight of their civilization. I mean, World War One comes, and that society is absolutely decimated. That upper class aristocratic society in England was destroyed by that war. And so there's something so poignant about writing about a time where people are declining and they have no idea.
They kind of almost have the veil over their eyes, and they're almost ignorant to the fact that this is going on. And like you said, World War One coming up, where it was set in a country that wasn't even involved really in World War One, was Austria, and the killing of the I think it was the Chancellor, was the killing of the Chancellor, which set it all off. But now,
Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
Archduke. And that is very interesting. And I think that this is what separates you from the rest of the romantic thrillers, is because you have done something here, with Lady Emily and with this time period, that you've explored it a lot greater, but you've also taken it and you've made it, you've always set people back and made it real, and you've made it like you live there, and that you've lived there and you've been reincarnated and come back, and now you're in the 2000s, in the year 2000, which is just fascinating. And it's very difficult to do.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, I've always loved history, and I always kind of, I don't know, I go back and forth. I used to think I was born in the wrong century, but now I'm just too used to my creature comforts, and so I don't think I could go back. But I think the thing is, when you're, certainly for me as a reader, and I think if you've got to approach writing as a reader. I mean, writing is really the ultimate reading experience, because everything works out the way you want it to, right? But as a reader who likes historical fiction, I want to be able to trust the author. I want to know, I mean, it's fiction, but I want to know that the history bits are right. I want to know that the details of how people lived are correct, because otherwise, I don't know, if you've got too many anachronisms, if you've got any anachronisms, it just pulls you right out of the narrative. So I think it's really important for historical writers to get those historical details right, because I think one of the reasons that people read historicals is they want to be able to know what it would have been like to live that way.
Exactly, and it's the same thing when you're watching a show or a TV series, and they're set back there, and then all of a sudden you catch something. It's supposed to be medieval times, and you see some guy with Nikes on by accident and tried to hide it. And you're like, oh, well, that just blew the whole thing for me now. It's like you couldn't, get some right shoes at least on the guy. I mean, if you get it on camera. Yeah. And we've all seen that. And it's like, well, that's ridiculous. And then they're all over the internet talking about all the things that they screwed up on. So,
Exactly.
Now, Now, here's something else, is that one of your books was a little bit The Golden Age, had nothing to do with your character,
right.
You know, Emily Ashton. Now, how did you get involved in writing the sequel to that book or to that movie, Elizabeth?
Well, it was honestly just a stroke of really good fortune. My agent called me one day, and she had a call from a wonderful editor at HarperCollins, who said that they had the rights to do a novel to go along with the sequel to the Elizabeth movie. And they wanted a writer who already had a reputation for being accurate with history. And so they asked me if I would do the book. And it was really different. It's such a different experience working that way,
right,
than just, you know, making something up on your own. And I, you know, had to do a lot of research on the Tudors and on Elizabeth, because you got to, especially when you're dealing with Hollywood. Hollywood isn't exactly known for historical accuracy. So
really,
yeah, I know, it's kind of shocking, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
But the studio was great about letting, because I had some issues with some of the history in the screenplay, and they gave me free rein when it came to expanding the story, because the screenplay, it doesn't give you enough meat for a novel. I mean, it's just not,
right.
You know, there's not enough there. And so I was given absolute free rein as to what I wanted to add. And then I also got them to let me put an author's note in so that the things that happened in the script that, you know, that I had to stick to, I was at least allowed to say, hey, this didn't actually happen, which I think is important. Because you don't want to read
right.
a book like that and then think, wait, that's not what happened. You know, you need to know that what's truth and what's fiction.
Right, and I think that Steve Barry, who's a historical fiction writer, does that extremely good, is he'll write at the end of his books and say, look, this is what was real, but this is what I made up, so
yeah.
Then you have a sense. And I think a lot more historical people should actually put that in their books, because it does leave you guessing, like, well, what was real and what wasn't? So
exactly.
Yeah.
And I think, too, one thing I've encountered a lot is that we as contemporary American readers have a lot of ideas about what we think is accurate history. And
right.
It's not always right, especially when it comes to the Victorians and social history. You know, they were not the staid, prudish people that their Edwardian grandparents or grandchildren would like us to think they were, you know. So there's a writer, I think, has a responsibility to tell the history accurately, even when it makes readers go, hang on, they couldn't have done that. When you know, but it's the writer's job then to say, yeah, actually, they could have done that, and here's why, you know.
Absolutely. So now here's a question I always like to ask, and because I've done a lot of, you know, plot versus character, and I'm trying to, you know, let people know what I feel is important when people are writing a book, because I'm trying to get people out of the mind frame of sit down and do an outline of your plot and then just work
right.
the characters in, because I think that is totally the wrong way to teach people how to write, and that's the old English professor way, and I think
yeah.
that's wrong. So my question to you is then, the chicken or the egg, was Lady Emily born first, or was the plot of your stories born first?
Oh, it was absolutely Emily first. I came up with the idea of her, and I wanted to tell her story. And the only way for me to figure out what her story was to get to know her. I mean, for me, it always comes down to the characters. There's nothing more important. And especially when you're writing, well, I mean, standalones too, but when you're writing a series, you know, you have the narrative arc of each individual installment. But there's also an arc that goes between books that's the character growing. Not so much, it's funny because we've been talking a lot at Love is Murder about the difference between character development and characters changing, because
mm-hmm.
it's not so much, I think we maybe do throw the word change around too much.
I think it's more growth. It's more character
growth. Exactly, because people do grow, and that
yeah.
sometimes that means they change, but not in a way that's breaking away from their true character. You're going to grow, but you're not necessarily going to become a different person.
Right.
But to me, you know, if I've got this young woman who I've set up in this, you know, I've created her character, the stories that she's going to be involved in have to come out of her situation and her world. And for me to start with the plot first, that just would never work. How would you know who lives there, you know, whose story it is?
Exactly.
Again, like, the person first, and then figure out her story.
Well, let me remind everybody here that we're talking with Tasha Alexander. Her website is TashaAlexander.com. The book is Dangerous Joe, came out October 2010, and it is your fifth in the series with Lady Emily Ashton, and it's set in the Victorian era, and it's a romantic thriller, but it's more along the lines of the thriller suspense, I think, than some of the romantic part of it, which is good for guys like me who like to get involved.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, romance, oh, no. When you're talking about somebody dying in the way of Jack the Ripper, you don't get much more thriller and in your face than that, which is what's fabulous about, you know, Dangerous to Know. So kind of along the same lines that you were talking on, which was the character growth, is, you know, you can't really put someone's life into 300 pages or 400 pages and let them, you know, grow that way. Because, like with anything, if you were to get kidnapped, you're going to come out of that a different person than you are before you got kidnapped, and your thing is going to change. And that's what that's not really changing. That's your growth as a person coming along. And that is something that is very, you know, that people like, because they like to see that character grow and not just be the same old-fashioned person written down that a lot of authors do when they write series, is that guy or that girl just stays exactly the same way, doesn't change, and it gets boring. Mm-hmm. You write 16 books, but the character hasn't changed. They just intermingle killers. It's just not the same.
Yeah. Well, and I noticed, for me as a reader, when I'm reading a series and I get to the end and I'm waiting for the next book, I can't wait to find out what happens to those characters next.
Exactly.
The plot of the previous book is completely resolved. There's nothing leaving you. You're not left hanging with that. But you get emotionally invested in these characters.
Right.
And that's what makes you want the next book.
The books that I love the best are the ones when you're reading and there's like three different storylines going on, mm-hmm. and the author takes you under one and you're going, and then all of a sudden it's like, and they're hanging off the cliff. And then you go to the next chapter, you're like, okay, what's going on? And then it takes you to the totally other storyline, and you're like, you SOB, I want to know what happened to this one. Get back to this part. And so
that's
you have
right.
to leave yourself hanging until it all works itself together. And I think that that's the, you know, that's the idea of the great thriller. And I think that that's just a continuation, like your series with Lady Emily here.
Yeah, I mean, it's so fun. And when especially at the end, when you finally pull all the threads together and you
mm-hmm.
see... You know, when you're reading and you get that big word, you know now how all these seemingly disparate things connect back together. It's so satisfying.
So to kind of wrap up a little bit, I have one more question, too, is I want to know, is Lady Emily coming to the U.S. in the future? What's going on with the future? And I want to know if she's coming to the U.S.
Probably not. I mean, I'll never say never because, you can't, at least I'm not a, you know, outline kind of girl where I've got this all plotted out in advance. I think she'll probably stay in Europe. The book that I've just turned in that's coming out in the fall is set in London. And I'm just getting ready to start writing the next one, the one for next year. And I'm debating, I had planned it to be set in Venice. I'd actually planted the seeds for this story in the very first book. Not the plot of it. It's just that, to be quite honest, I'd always wanted to go to Venice. And I thought, well, if I leave a little thing in here that someday there needs to be Emily going to Venice, and maybe I could go to Venice too.
That would be nice.
Venice. Yeah, wouldn't it? That wouldn't be too horrible, right?
Yeah, no.
So I'm thinking Venice. But then there's also a little nagging idea that I've got that would keep her in England for another book. She's gone around quite a bit. She's been in England, London, Paris, Vienna, Constantinople. So, you know, might not be bad to stay in England again.
Yeah, and
I definitely
know what,
want to bring her to Russia at some point. I think she needs to go to the Tsar's coronation.
That would definitely be interesting because Russia was always one of those, of course, we're growing up, you know, the Red Scare and everything else.
Yeah.
And Russia was always like, ooh, big bad Russia, big bad Russia. But they have some fabulous history over there that I think people need to know and be explored besides the fact of just Lenin and Stalin and those types of people. So.
Yeah.
Well,
so, yeah,
Tasha,
so the U.S., I think, I can't see Emily in the United States.
Okay. Well, maybe I was thinking maybe the Titanic. You know, I don't know.
You never know. Like I said.
But the Titanic didn't have to sink when she was on it, but maybe she's coming over to the United States on the Titanic and something happens, or a boat like the Titanic, and you know,
yeah,
something kind of happens, and then she ends up in the southern pre, you know, post Civil War South, and who knows? I don't know.
It could be fun. Never say never.
That's true. Well, Tasha, I'll tell you, it's been great having you on. I want to thank you so much for joining us and taking the time out from the Conference of Love is Murder in Chicago. Again, the book, Dangerous to Know, available now. And we've been speaking with Tasha Alexander. So, Tasha, again, thank you so much. We look forward to seeing you out here in April for your next appearance in Los Angeles twice in April. So,
yeah. Well, thanks so much for having me, John. It was a blast.
Thank you again. So you have a great time and enjoy yourself. Now that all your panels are done, you go have fun.
Thanks so much. You have a great day.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
So again, everybody, Tasha Alexander. The website is TashaAlexander.com. One of the greatest right now in the era, romantic thriller writers that is just out there doing some great work. And you know, when you're talking a heroine in the Victorian age and bringing all that together, along with the old-time kind of murder mystery sagas, like I said, back in the Agatha Christie story or Arthur Conan, the Doyle age, and bringing all those things together, it's just, you know, don't let the romance think that it's not anything thriller, because then you're going to be dead wrong, and I do mean to pun the word dead. But now we're going to move on to our next guest. And we were going to have her on, but she had an upper respiratory infection on Tuesday. And hopefully she's better, because if I get sick over the microphone, I'm going to have to hurt her. And I know where she lives. So I want to bring in the author of In the Name of Revenge, talking about her next book here, which just came out, Deadly Decisions. Star Rena, everybody knows Star because she's guest-starred with us on the show before. Tell us about Deadly Decisions, Star. How are you doing?
Hey, John. Thanks for rescheduling me to today. Tuesday I was quite sick, so I wasn't able to.
You get me sick. I know where you live. You get me sick.
Yes, and I will not get you sick through the microphone.
So they say.
But I will apologize in advance if I start coughing.
That's okay. You can cough. Just go get some water. But
yeah.
So we were going to have you on Tuesday because February 1st was the launch of Deadly Decisions, the second book in your series. So tell everybody about, you know, Deadly Decisions and the sequel here to In the Name of Revenge.
Okay, I want to take a step back before I mention Deadly Decisions to In the Name of Revenge. I think most people already know and have read In the Name of Revenge. I'd like to think of that as Pavel Ivanovich's backstory. It tells the reader who he is and how he got to be where he's at and who he is today. And then it moves on into Deadly Decisions, where his true identity is revealed in The Name of Revenge at the end. And in Deadly Decisions, you get to see him now is as that whole person who is an FBI agent. He experiences several traumatic incidences in Deadly Decisions. And with him in this book is Teresa Mancini. Now, she is barely introduced in The Name of Revenge. She, at the end, does become his girlfriend at her actual insistence. But she's quite the character. And you'll get to see her more in Deadly Decisions and who she is and how she just involves herself in Pavel's world more so than he even wants her to be. And in Deadly Decisions, what he's trying to do, Pavel that is, he wants to try to find a new direction now that his revenge has been sort of fulfilled earlier. And instead of finding new direction, he just finds himself into more mayhem and more trouble, and bullets are flying, bombs are exploding, people are getting hurt. And Teresa is
all hell's breaking loose, basically, right?
Absolutely, all hell breaks loose with Teresa right there with him.
Now, when you're talking about something like In the Name of Revenge, and they get the revenge, do you explore the emotional standpoint? Because a lot of writers and a lot of things do that. That once that revenge has taken place, you can get you can kind of go either way. Either they feel vindicated and they feel fine, or really it didn't really take the pain away, and it's still there. It's just it's more of a closure. Do you explore that one of those two kind of emotional roller coasters for Pavel?
I do. In the Name of Revenge, the readers, I'm sure, saw that he didn't really get his complete closure, but you could see where he is working through it himself and how he has to learn to deal with his ex-girlfriend, Felice, her decisions not to go back into his world again because he just hurt her beyond repair. So he has to actually heal through that. And I brought the reader through kind of the steps of where he's beginning to heal so that when he, by the time he's over into Deadly Decisions now, he's better. But it does refer back to his old hurt, but how he's moving on. So, yeah, I do try to address that.
Now, the roller coaster ride, I don't know if you heard, you know, like Tasha Alexander talking about her character coming and the growth of the characters, because, you know, I'm trying to let people know that the characters, I believe, is more important than the plot, and to let writers know that if you really want to get yourself on a good story and a good line, think of a fabulous character and work the plot around it. Now, is that something, you know, like I said, the chicken before the egg, is that what you did? Were your characters born and then you put them in the situation, or did you do it the other way where you kind of thought of what's going on and then you had the, you know, then you worked your characters into them?
A little of both, I think. With my series is definitely character-driven. It's all about the characters and what they, debacles they get into. It's not all about plot. I think that if you have good characters, the plot comes naturally, what needs to happen to them. And they ultimately tell you what the plot should be, not you telling what the plot is and then the character being interwoven into it. To me, that doesn't seem to work well. It seems almost forced, if you will, at least on my part. My character is first and foremost, or shall I say plural, characters. Mm-hmm. They are first and foremost, and then the plots work themselves around them, and what happens is dependent upon the character. Because like Tasha was saying, and I did hear that, characters do grow. And in a sense, yes, they change only because of that growth that they're having. And from when, particularly when you're writing a series, like Tasha said, your characters are going to change to some degree because they are growing. Different things affect their life, which takes them to different directions that they originally thought. They're like real people, and those real people in a fictional tale obviously have to grow just like you and I would. If we were put into a situation like this, how would we handle it? We don't even know until we become involved in that particular plot or that scene. And so therefore, when the character is thrown into that scene, how are they going to react? They grow, they change, they may digress, but your strong characters are not going to digress. They're not going to go backwards. They're moving forward, and they're growing.
Now, as you go forward with your characters, what do you find is the biggest challenge to keep them fresh? And do you kind of have an ending in your head where you're like, all right, I know I'm only going to do 4 books or 5 books, and then I'm going to be done with them, because you just don't feel that you can continue them and, you know, having them keep growing. Do you have those thoughts into your head? Do you feel that that's going to come up sometime in the future?
I've thought about that, and the answer to that is really the response from my readers and fans that I have. If they want to travel with Pavel and on more of his cases, then I will write them. However, he has to have a reason for being. And if his reasons in my world, if they cease to exist, then he needs to either change dramatically or we need to stop the series. And I think the only way to know that is through your readers and your fans. They'll tell you. And I'm dependent upon them to tell me, hey, your character's getting stale. Of course, that's not something I want to hear, because that means I've penned him stale. But it all does come down to your fans and your readers. What do they want? What do they want to see? What do they want to read? You know, are they done with him? Should we move him on, or should we discontinue the series. And I think that's how I'm going about looking at it, is to see what everyone else wants.
Now, you have, I think you already have a third book in the works, either finished or getting finished, correct?
It's in the works.
So we know that we're going to at least see them here for book three, which is good. But now, when you're looking between In the Name of Revenge, Two Deadly Decisions, to now going on number three, do you feel that the that their upward swing was how you envisioned it way back at the beginning, or has it just gone totally off board and you're just like, wow, I had no idea it was even going to happen this way?
Well, in a sense, a part of it is as I envisioned, in the sense that with Pavel, I knew that he was going to grow. His story needed to be told, and his story, his backstory, like I said, was told in the Name of Revenge. He's now grown, and he's moving forward. In Deadly Decisions, you can see that he has changed as far as his character, because his number one issue for even joining the FBI, as revealed in the first book, is revenge. He has now realized his revenge, and he's moved on. So because of that reason, I can see Pavel moving forward with Teresa. Teresa has freshened up the scene, so to speak. She's actually vying for the reader's attention, from what the few comments I've gotten from different readers, that how much they love her and how strong of a character she is as well. So
right.
I think that the future books, as far as I can see right now, Teresa is going to go along with Pavel on this ride and this journey, and through his crime-ridden and cases that he's going to be trying to solve, and she'll be with him in the mix. And I think that's where I'm headed with it. And the third book, like I said, yes, I am working on it. At present, the title is One Major Mistake, but that's a working title. That could change. But, yeah, I can see the series going forward.
So when what I want to try to understand on this one is also, and I had something, this is the second time this happened. I don't know if it's just age or what, but I'm getting the Alzheimer's early here, is that I'm trying to, I had a question going on. Let me come back to that, because I do have something else I want to talk about. You are very much, because you are independent, kind of an indie author, you have to do a lot of aggressive marketing. Now, what are some of the things that you can tell, other indie authors, or even authors that are, it doesn't make a difference if you're with Random House or whoever, you still need to do marketing. What have you done that you've seen successful to try to help authors out, say, this is the new technology, this is what I believe is working, and you just want to let people know?
Market. The first, before you can sell anything, I don't care what it is, you have to sell yourself first. And you can't sell yourself if no one knows who you are. So the first thing you need to do is get your name out. It's harder than it sounds. You can start with, and which is where I've started, is Goodreads, Facebook, Twitter. Get out there on those social networks. Let these people know that you exist. Offer them a taste of what you're writing. Let them, to find out if they like, what you're writing, and if they want to continue reading it. Now, what I've done for Deadly Decisions, which it was a wonderful idea that was given to me, is In the Name of Revenge, I gave away for 2 days for free. So those who hadn't yet read it could
free.
Read it.
We all love the free word, baby.
Free,
yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And what it's doing is, to me as an author, I'm not losing anything, because it's not about how many can I sell, how much money can I make. It's how many people out there can sit down and enjoy a good story that you've written and just escape. That was my whole purpose of writing to begin with. So I gave away In the Name of Revenge for 2 days straight free, so that they could get a sense of who Pavel is prior to reading Deadly Decisions.
Right.
Even though you can still read Deadly Decisions without having read the first one and still know what's going on. But it did help, and I've heard that went over well, that people enjoyed that ability to be able to do that, to be able to read it. So I encourage you know, the debut authors, you know, let's not worry about the buck that you're making. Let's worry about getting your story out there and getting your name out there. Because if you don't do something to show the readers that you care about what they want to read and helping them, then you're kind of smacking yourself in the face, in my opinion. So, yeah, I just get it out there. Just do what your readers want. As far as, you know, helping them out.
Right. And, you know, that, and when you said that, it reminded me of what I was going to ask you, which was this, was now that you've kind of gone on the road of Pavel and Teresa and you're going on their road now, have you, in your writing here, In the Name of Revenge and Deadly Decisions, has it kind of hit you another story that's gotten inside of you with another kind of character, totally different from Pavel and Teresa, that you want to let out, that you might let out in the future after your third book here is written, and maybe try to do, you know, two character lines at once, bring them maybe together, do a total standalone. Is there a story in you that you need to let out, not a Pavel Teresa story that's kind of built itself up since you've been writing them?
Yes, but it's in a total different genre, actually.
That's all right.
I'm trying my hand at a paranormal book. I have started that as well, so I'm kind of working on the third in the Ivanovich series, but I'm working on a paranormal book as well. I think that's going well. I'm enjoying doing it because it is a different genre, which holds a different voice than you would see in, you know, a crime series. So that's been entertaining for me as well. So, yeah, there's a story there that I want to get out that I'm hoping my fans will read and accept as well as they've accepted the Ivanovich series.
I want to remind everybody that we are speaking here with Star Rena, and her website is queenwriter.com. You can go find out about her books. The book we're talking about is Deadly Decisions. It's the second book in the series, where the first one was In the Name of Revenge. She is an indie writer, ebook extraordinaire on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can find it, Smashwords, and anywhere else you can find ebooks. It's available for your reader to download and get on. I also remind everybody that coming up here very shortly, we are going to announce the top 10 Suspense Magazine finalists of the short story contest. And that's going to be coming up here, you know, in about 5 minutes. So I want people that are hanging on to listen to that to just hang on 5 minutes longer. You know, I'm not going to give it to you at the beginning. Did you think I was going to do that? No, I'm going to give it to you at the end. So, Star.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of short stories and things like that, I've always wondered if anybody's ever done this, because some, and I don't know if they have, I think I've seen it maybe once or twice, but it's been more in science fiction genres. Because a lot of the books don't end directly after, like In the Name of Revenge went into Deadly Decisions, but I don't think there was a lot of time period between the two. Am I correct?
Yeah.
So now going forward, if there was ever a time when it's like a year later, or you're going to set it a year or 2 years after, would you ever consider writing a short little novella, kind of filling in that space between books, to just kind of, you know, something like what 24 did when their show, like Redemption, they kind of did that little 1.5, 2 hour, you know, special that kind of tied two things together. Is that something that you've ever thought about doing, just to do a little something extra?
Yeah, I think they're called halves. And, yeah, it's not a bad consideration, and I might just very well do that. I think it would depend upon how the writing goes with the third novel, and if I am going to wait another year before getting out the fourth one, then it is definitely a consideration. Kind of a side story of, you know, what could happen on the, you know, what they're up to on the side, work that in. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely a consideration.
Now, and in your books, you like to, you know, kind of take readers on an emotional journey back and forth. And, you know, and it's a little bit of scare. You know, you scare people with, you know, things jumping out, or especially now you're doing paranormal. So you're trying to get people into, you know, getting scared and, you know, preying on that kind of deep emotional level. What scares you? What are you afraid of? And do you put that in your writing to kind of let the demons out?
Well, yeah, I kind of try and let the demons out, but
besides being afraid of your pet chihuahua and not being there. What are you afraid of?
My 6-pound dog, you know, was at my
yes,
friend's
he's,
house last
he's
night.
Brutal.
I stole him.
He's brutal.
Yeah. But other than that fear of him wanting to jump ship over to my friend's house for life, I'd have to say snakes. No, I've not worked that into my writing because I can't stand the idea. I have a fear of snakes. I don't care if they're a garden snake or what they are. Snakes are just bad. And they are what frightens me.
So that would be something that you don't even think would be maybe like therapeutic to kind of, you know, put that into your work and maybe kind of let that out because, you know, that might be and just you know, just an idea. That might give that more sense of like realism scary because you're writing it almost shaking as you're typing it.
I mean, it's not a bad idea, but and if there's a reason to put a snake in there for, you know, for God knows what reason, but if there is a reason, then I would
do it.
You
could always throw a cobra in the closet.
Jump out at Teresa, maybe, or something. Yeah. No, that would be funny. I think it would be more funny than it would be scary if it involved Teresa. But at any rate, if there's a reason, I guess, to throw a snake in the mix, then I wouldn't be opposed to doing that. And, yeah, I guess it would be therapeutic to write and incorporate your fear into a novel because you know it's not something that you're actually experiencing, even though palms may be sweaty, fingers may be, you know, itching while you're trying to type this thing. But, yeah, it's something worth thinking about, you know, and if there's a reason, like I said, maybe I'll throw one in. Who knows? It could be a cobra eating a chihuahua.
You never know. Like he's more like a mongoose. Well, I'll tell you what, Star, we've come to the end. I really appreciate it. We're going to have you back on, of course, maybe guest hosting again. The book is Deadly Decisions. It is available now. Queenwriter.com is the website. Star Arena, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, queenwriter.com. The book is Deadly Decisions, Star Arena. And now we are going to get on to the top 10 finalists of the Suspense Magazine 2010 writing contest. I need a little bit of music behind me to do this. Nothing better than Halloween music. So here we go. The envelope, please. This is in no particular order. I just want to let you know that. Here are the top 10 finalists in the Suspense Magazine Writing Contest 2010. Number 10, or number 1, whatever you want to say again, no particular order. August Unwinding. By Maurice Ott, Baloo III. And I'm sorry if I said the last name wrong. Beautiful Blue Eyes by Jaina V. Rockfeld. Number 3, Daddy by Sam Stevens. Number 4, Entry by Kevin Erickson. Number 5, Round Midnight by Quentin Peterson. Number 6, The Alston Dance by Bridget Branson. Number 7, The $1 Million Mistake by Lois Browning Bauer. Number 8, The Waiting, which is what I made you all do, by James Kelly. Number 9, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? By Mark T. Sullivan. And number 10, Naughty and Nice by Bradley Convisser. Those are the 10, everybody. Those are the 10 finalists. What will win? Who will it be? I don't know. If you want to vote, you can go on Facebook. You can email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com. Tell us who you think. If you've read any of these stories, I'm not sure which ones we've have up online. That's for the creative team to do that. But those are the 10 entries. So, again, I'll read them off again real quick. Again, no particular order. Number 10, August Unwinding by Maurice Ballou III. Number 9, Beautiful Blue Eyes by Jana Brockfeld. Number 8, Daddy by Sam Stevens. Number 7, Entry, Kevin Erickson. Number 6, Round Midnight by Quentin Peterson. Number 5, The Arlston Dance by Bridget Branson. Number 4, The $1 Million Mistake by Louise Browning Bauer. Number 3, The Waiting by James G. Kelly. Number 2, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire by Mark T. Sullivan. And number 1 or 10, Naughty and Nice by Bradley Convisser. Again, no particular order. Those are just the 10 finalists for the top for the short story contest. They will be announced in the issue of the magazine. We will make sure we post it on Facebook. Follow us on Facebook for many exclusive announcements also, because we do have a lot of stuff out there that we give to our readers and our fans, you know, for free. We had our fan appreciation page up, which means you can go back and check out Suspense Magazine. The early years back in 2009, what were we? So go ahead, and suspensemagazine.com is where you'll find us. You'll find us on Facebook and Twitter, MySpace, all over the place. And it's been a pleasure. Tasha Alexander, on TashaAlexander.com. No, Sarina with us on SpeedWriter.com. Post them right now. Go out to whatever. Find first. Part. Again, it's been great. Check us out on Blog Talk Radio for our next radio event. And we want to thank everybody for being here. Good night, everybody. Good day, everybody. Wherever you're at, stay warm, stay cool. We will talk with you all next time. So until then, we will see you.